Are you seeking more creativity in your life? Join us, Nadia and me, Laura, the hosts of the Creative Rumble podcast.
Each week, we delve into the minds of inspirational creatives, share their wisdom and our own creative journeys. We explore how to align yourself, develop creative ideas, and find inspiration.
Join us as we explore what it takes to live a creative life so you too can feel the creative rumble.
Living a creative life is for everyone. Let's Creative Rumble.
The Creative Rumble podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of this country and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' continuing connection to land, sea, waterways, sky and culture. We pay respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Hello, Creative Rumblers, tuning in from Tasmania to across the globe. We're so glad you've joined us for another episode, whether you're walking the dog, working in your studio, or taking a quiet moment for yourself. In today's conversation with the incomparable Rick Goddard, we dive deep into something we know many of you will relate to, the courage it takes to back yourself, especially in the face of uncertainty. Rick reminds us that creativity isn't just about making, it's about listening, leading, failing, and finding the wonder in starting again. Nadia Aliff Robinson and I, Laura Purcell, are excited to welcome Rick Goddard to the Creative Rumble podcast, a master storyteller whose career spans radio, theatre, live performance, and personal transformation. Known to many as one of Australia's longest-serving ABC breakfast presenters, Rick brings a rare mix of intellect, warmth, and improvisational brilliance to every space he enters. He's a TEDx speaker, an award-winning educator, a Moth Story Slam winner, and the creative force behind keynotes, performances, and workshops that challenge, connect, and inspire. In this expansive conversation, we explore Rick's reflections on creativity, leadership, and the real shape of success. He speaks candidly about the power of failure, losing a job that defined him, and how that pain reshaped his understanding of what it means to lead with empathy, humour, and curiosity. Rick brings a deep reverence for conversation itself, inviting us to be kind to the material, whether we're navigating a stage, a story, or a hard moment in life. We also dive into his upcoming book, which unpacks masculinity with unflinching honesty and a dose of much-needed wit. You'll hear about Rick's approach to growing beyond toxic models of leadership, finding wonder in small beginnings, and learning to truly listen to others and to yourself. Alongside his powerful keynote and coaching work, Rick's performances, MC gigs, and workshops leave audiences laughing, thinking, and forever changed. This episode contains a few F-bombs and a lot of soul. So if you're after better conversations, deeper connection, and a reminder that your story matters, this one's for you. Hi.
Hi.
I feel a bit nervous, but that's the way it goes.
Fangirl nervous.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not allowed to fangirl me because we've worked together.
Yeah. But I've just
For years.
Yeah, and I've had lots of flashbacks of a lot of times we've worked together or I've learnt from you or being on the performance floor. And then when I'm also like going into the Tanifa time machine and having these creative activations with people, I go, well, where did that start? You know?
Yeah.
Like you opened up so many channels for me to be able to start exploring and it's, yeah.
But 100% with you, like with so many people who went through that company, it ended as collaborators. Mm. And I think that the structure there was very flat. So once people had the skills, then they were working as co-collaborators. Mm. And I didn't experience it as hierarchical. I was at the top, so whatever. No, but like, you know, we Red Message Service, like we were all co-collaborators in that
That's
group,
right.
I thought.
Yeah.
You know, because by then you all had your skills.
Yeah, we did.
And we had those and watching people go from I'm sort of curious about performance but I don't want to do a play to going, I'm a fully fledged artist doing cross media work with different people, often internationally by the end of it, or with Terrapin, who are still there, thank God. That's like enormously satisfying. And I was at a party once, and the way that my job ended at that company was really unpleasant. And it was all out of my control. So it's one of those moments where you're the main character, right? Because you're the artistic director of the theatre company. And then all of this stuff happens. And I didn't find out till years later that none of what had happened had anything to do with me.
Oh, that's not
I was collateral damage in someone else's drama. And it was so painful and so humiliating, the way that I lost that job. All of the artistic work of the company was destroyed. It was then actively denigrated live on stage in a comedy performance for the launch of the new theatre company built on its bones. Like, it was so intense. Anyway, I was at a party and I was talking about how that had been difficult and was kind of a failure and stuff. And one person there who's now quite successful director was like, stop there. Don't you dare say that. And then she talked about how I'd influenced her and that she had come as a high school student to lessons and was now directing shows and was a producer entrepreneur. And she got really angry with me actually for being down on myself about it. And that was a wake up call to, because most of our work is to do with failure. We always failing to not swim in that sea and to frame your successes and take those things away with you and build on them. It was a good moment.
That was a turning point.
I think that was a turning point in my sense of humiliation about how that job had ended. And it's interesting because, again, when we succeed, do we learn very much? We learn so much when we fail. You know, I just interviewed the guys who set up Canva, who's worth $30 billion. I'm sitting on stage with this guy's worth $30 billion. Mm. And I'm going, I want to talk about the things you failed at. And he said, yeah, because success is uninteresting. Mm. We don't learn anything from success. Mm. It's really boring, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, for him, $30 billion boring, so whatever. Yeah. But that was a moment I could reframe that. But when you lose a leadership role like that, it's totally crushing. You know, when the chair of the board comes and says, oh, we'd like to bring your contract forward to the end of the year and you don't know why. Mm. And you've all just worked together on a 3-year plan to transition to a new artistic director in a way that was healthier than what I got, which was dropped in the deep end and everyone had left with no mentorship. So there were all these structures. We'd worked with every single stakeholder, had a say in this plan. It was a beautiful plan.
Yeah.
Mm. I just had a child and it was on paternity leave.
Yeah.
And I had one of those moments actually where 15 years later, 8 years later, I don't know how many years later, and I'm interviewing a woman about why men don't take paternity leave in Australia, you know, classic ABC local radio interview. And the statistics say that they're discouraged by their employers, they're discouraged by their friends. And I went, oh my God, that all blew up when I was on paternity leave, included a board member saying, oh, you're so entitled. What is these ambit claims for this luxurious life? I had my children and went back to work. Someone else saying you're not present enough and the artists are all lost without you. Where are you? Where have you been? I was outrageous. Like, I'm on paternity leave.
Yeah.
And, it was all of this idea that, like, without our leader there sitting 24/7 on call, anything other than that isn't what leadership is. Mm. So
very old school model.
It's very old school. And it's
not
so
not how the modern world works at all.
No.
Yeah.
No. And you look now at them putting rules like that on and going, no, that was just a lie. Mm. It was just made up crap. Yeah. And that's happened a few times in my career where I'm going, why am I the person fighting for this? I thought women sorted this out with feminism in 1986, that I'm fighting to be a leader who can spend time with their children. Or as a solo parent after I was divorced, having to have really robust negotiations around being part-time and a breakfast presenter. Mm. Because it was forward facing.
Yeah.
And they're like, what does it say to the audience if you just come and go willy nilly? And I'm like, well, maybe it says that you're actually honoring the employment agreement and your ABC core values and the Charter of Human Rights. I had a great lawyer. And they're like, oh, yeah, good point. You should do that. And now the way that we're all employed, certainly here in Hobart at ABC, it's ultra flexible. Amazing bosses who go, what do you need? Mm. And then they get the best.
That's how it should be. Yeah.
It's so It's so easy. So I'm really passionate. This is rambling, but
I know.
When I was the boss of the theatre company, I was really passionate that everyone's work conditions were professional. We were a trainly funded professional theatre company. So I didn't want people like doing 14 hours overtime. And I was like, we're paid to do this. We knew what everyone wanted. We knew where everyone was going. We knew what we were doing to facilitate it. We knew we weren't paying them what they were worth, but we were paying them what we were funded. And we were able to support so many people into so many careers. I never got surprised by anyone leaving because they knew that I knew where they were going and we were helping them get there. It was incredibly enjoyable. But again, when I started, the general manager, I only took the job. I was so inexperienced. And I said, I'm only taking this because that general manager is really experienced. And they're like, yep, yep, absolutely. Signed the contract, turned up. He left after 2 months. They all knew. And I was like, whoa. So then I had no general manager for ages. And again, coming back to part-time work. So I'm totally inexperienced. I'm in Tasmania, which was like the backwards wear of nothing at the time. When I took the job, people like, that will destroy your career and reputation. No one's looking for new ideas from there. That's changed now. But I went, look, I've met all of these incredible women at parties who have got so much experience, who've just had children. And I reckon we go and hit them up to be part-time general manager. And the board again were like, what? But it's a general manager. That's a full-time person. That's a, you know, like literally you see a man, don't you, at that time. A man full-time and there's someone behind him making life work. And he's, but anyway, so we approached, there was a whole bunch of incredible women out there.
And we're talking like early 2000s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 1999, 2000. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that long, I mean, you know, it's not that long. It's not 1965.
Yeah.
So I rang Annette Downs. She had been an incredibly successful artistic director of Terrapin Theatre Company. She had a performance background. She had won a Telstra Small Businesswoman of the Year award for the touring and international touring she created out of this little schools touring puppet company, Visionary. She just had twins. And I'm like going, yo, so new in town. Hi. Text Theatre's dead, whatever. But like, let's do contemporary performance, which the previous artistic director had created this amazing sort of performance space, Sydney-esque international culture within the company. So it's very much building on that. And that's what I was hired to do. And she was like, like, I'm kind of breastfeeding two twins. No, like I've just finished. She was. And they were just, oh, she goes, yeah. Ugh. And we dragged her back in. So she mentored me. And she was so generous and I'd have a stupid idea and be like, yeah, yeah, because there's a guy. Yeah, we'll do this. She goes, or we could do this, which is better and more sensible and also do that. What do you think, boss? And I was like, yeah, I think we should do this and do that. And she'd just laugh at me. And then we'd be sitting poring over budgets and she'd look up and realize she was an hour late for school pickup. Children crying in the schoolyard. But it was that was a lifesaver. That was a total lifesaver. But again, it was the ability to go, what do you do to get the best people? Mm. And what you do to get the best people is you give them the absolute best conditions under which to work for them. Instead of this top-down thing of we're going to impose on you what we believe work should look like. And isn't it interesting that after COVID happened and we all learned that?
Yeah, complete shift. Yeah.
Total. That now everyone's trying to wheel it back. Well, not everyone, but there's a group of people really invested in wheeling it back.
Crazy.
I'm interested in how from starting out, like how you became a leader. Have you always been a leader, like growing up in school to when you were, you know, you moved from New Zealand to Australia and lived in Melbourne and like was that always innate in you?
Being outspoken is innate in me.
Me too.
Right? So I've got a lot of friends, weirdly, I've got a lot of friends who were head prefects at school and I'm like, that was not me. You know, the authorities never wanted me near any levers of like power or anything because I was dangerous. I got described at acting school as being the archetype of the fool. So you perform for royalty with a gun pointed at your head. And I have since learned how to be the prince and also the king because that became a thing for me to have the gravity. Where's the gravity? It's a lifelong search for gravity. But on my school reports would say, you know, very outspoken, wonderful contributor to class, which means can't keep his mouth shut, and has leadership potential if only he applied himself. So all I heard was has leadership potential. And those school reports, like if you're one of the people who writes them, like they're powerful. They're really powerful. Mm. No one in my family treated me like a leader. I was the youngest of four. So they all knew everything already. They could do everything already. I was basically stupid, a bit slow, clumsy and incompetent and never learned to do anything because they already had done it. And in my family, knowing things was the highest value. More than doing things, more than being loving. Like no one talked about love or being loving in my family. That was not something. They were, but it wasn't discussed. So I think the leadership thing is about I'm willing to step up and out and be seen and step into public space. I am not afraid to fail. And I think part of that came from when I was a teenager, I had a band. Two of the guys from the band ended up in Germany. So I was like, I'm going to go to Germany and be in a rock band. So I dropped out of school. I got a job in a mail clerk, saved up my money, went to do that. And the day I arrived, my mate Dean was like, I'm following this girl back to New Zealand.
Oh, dear.
Because I love her. And I'm like, well, she's not into you, man. And I've like lived my whole life in order to get here and how dare you do this, you know, and was like fully codependent and I've apologized to him since then.
He's bless.
Yeah, no, he's like, man, if I never would have done anything if you hadn't made that happen. So anyway, he took off, I got left in London and everything I had lived for fell in a heap. And I'm in a graveyard in Germany and it's snowing and I'm sitting there and even as I'm thinking, this is everything I've lived for, this is my dream. I was like, yeah, but my heart's still beating. My legs are here. I'll just spend a year and a half here then and then go back to uni.
Yeah.
And that was an amazing lesson to get at that point in life, to have been that attached.
How old were you then? Like in your early
20s? 18, 19.
Yeah.
And
so sort of like your first sort of like transformation time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Into adulthood.
Absolutely. Mm. And like propelled into it. Then I'm living in squats in London. And finding a job. I got a job at the Royal Opera House at Covent Garden. So I just went around and knocked on doors until someone gave me a job. And I went in at the stage door there. I'd been watching the buskers perform. And I went in at the stage door and said, I do everything from singing to cleaning. And the guy's like, 1 second. And for this really happy minute, I stood there thinking, yeah, they've seen something in me. You know how we dream that? That we'll get spotted?
Yeah.
Like a model in Target. I'm 13 years old and was in Target. I got spotted as an international model.
That was my dream.
Yeah. So this dream thing is freaking insidious. It's so insidious because it isn't a dream. Like the people who get anywhere and do anything worthwhile, they might be visionaries, which is really different than having a dream. Like we can all have a dream. That's so nice. Mm. But they work really hard. And also all the people who, and I really saw this running that theatre company, the artists I was hiring who were killer professionals who were going to just be major people in the world of arts and do stuff. And that was people I'd worked with in Wellington and people I worked with here. And they are all those people now. They're really good at filing. They had really organized computers.
They all had Macs.
Yeah. And everything was color coded. They could find everything they needed. This idea that creative people were somehow hopeless or chaotic. It's like, no, people who are hopeless and chaotic are hopeless and chaotic, and you can find them in all fields of life. People who are going to be successful as artists are like super organized. Mm. They're really good communicators. They're really good collaborators. They're working often in marginal industries where it's so hard to keep jobs and nothing can be taken for granted. And what I love about those people is that their work ethic's off the show. Like so off the show. So when I was divorced, I had this problem, which is that in order for all my children to live and eat and my ex to be able to study, to get onto her life, like everyone needed to still be supported. So I had to be able to work. So I couldn't leave my program at ABC to freelance as much as that might've been attractive at that moment of breakdown in life.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do I do this? You know? And then I went, oh, I just need people to stay at my house. Then I go to work, then I can come back and pick the kids up and then I can take them to school. And they just need to know that someone is there. Who would be those people? And in the end, everyone who did that job was a performer. They were all theatre people. And some of them are actually like super famous now. So Niara was one of those people.
Oh, wow.
Like incredible people. Bella was one of those people.
But they were there for you and they helped with that.
Yeah, and I could rely on, I just like, if a theatre person says they're going to be somewhere at a time, they're going to be there at a time. So they would sometimes arrive at the end of their evening at 10, 11 o'clock. I'd be asleep.
Yeah.
Kids would be asleep. I'd be asleep. And I would just know that they'd have come in, locked every door and window, gone to sleep in the babysitter bedroom, and they'd be with my children in the morning for that couple of hours.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was the most brilliant solve, and they were people I could trust.
Yeah.
Was I a private nanny? I don't know. Don't think so. People like it's the theatre ethos. This is why it works for breakfast radio. So breakfast radio people don't call in sick. Like they turn up and then they go home sick afterwards. Yeah. That's just how you roll. And my longevity in the role is partly because I'm so reliable. The idea of having another person, if you're the manager, is a nightmare because you can't sleep. You don't know if they'll ring. Will they be there? Won't they be there?
Yeah.
And that was learned doing theatre. That's learned turning up for the show, no matter how your day is, no matter how your energy is. And knowing that once the show starts, it looks after you.
Yeah. And the show must go on. So
the show goes on.
The show goes on.
Yeah.
It goes on.
Yeah.
We talked about resilience and reliability. Actually, I just want to delve into a little bit more about the difference between being a visionary and a dreamer.
So I had a crisis of when I went freelance, of like, well, what am I? What do I do? And for creative people, this is a really big issue for us. So having hosted a whole lot of small business awards, and thank you, Clarence Council, for all those jobs, the people who win small business awards generally all have the same speech and they go, we were single-minded. We had one idea and we have just lived and breathed it all about every day. We do this, you know, it's like we move furniture, we do wiring, you know, we build a bridge and it doesn't fall down. And that's all we ever thought about for 15 years. Like a lot of creative people I work with are not single-minded. Now you're allowed to be multiplicitous. It's interesting with art. If you were a slashy when I started out, you weren't proper artist because you hadn't chosen.
Yes, I've heard a bit of this in interviews we've done with people already about like feeling this intense pressure to actually select yourself into a stream of I have to be a painter or I have to now do.
Yeah.
Because ceramics. A real painter wouldn't also be something else.
Mm, that's right.
Actor slash model. Yeah. And it's interesting because that's co-evolved with sexuality. Which I think is super interesting.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So we're in a world now where you are allowed to have a multiplicitous sexuality. It can change identity. This has definitely not always been the case. And even in, like, I remember in the 80s in the gay movement, people who were bi were seen as really suspicious because they were standing in two camps and not making a choice. Yeah. You know, what are you really? And now it's like you can be whatever you want to be. But in terms of creativity, if you've got 12 interests, you'll probably have success later because you will slowly develop in each of your streams over this long period of time until you crystallize into something, you know, incredible. And I know you've spoken heaps of people about parenting and creativity as well and motherhood and creativity and how it slows it down. But it doesn't kill it. And it's interesting to see Jane Longhurst, for example, like she is like a diamond at the moment. You know, she is just
sparkling,
initiating work, putting on shows, directing shows, producing things.
What night was it? Thursday?
Yes, Thursday night.
Thursday.
You got to see the preview.
She was like, there was sparkles.
Yeah.
Buzz. Huge. Yeah.
And that's someone who has started her career several times, you know, in Melbourne, then in Aubrey Wodonga, then came back here, jobbing actor. Always had that actor ambition and she's transformed as an artist into just more strings to the bow. So.
But, and as we use Jane Longhurst, hi Jane, shout out to you. But as we use that as an example of all the strings in the bow that then do end up just making the show layered and rich and she's able to communicate with so many people on different levels and her audience is so big and broad and she's able to reach out. So all of that sort of understanding how to communicate, understanding how the artistry behind, you know, whether it's the set or the actor or like all of that comes together.
And that's where longevity is so important. So that's where a company like Terrapin that has got, is it even 5-year funding now there or triennial at least, that artists have time and support to develop ideas. You don't get the show Terrapin are doing, you know, it's 6 years in development. That would have been 2 years before that that they would have thought of it. And that's the difference, I think, coming back to visionary or dreaming, right? So when you're artistic director of a theatre company, you have to provide the vision. What are we going to do? Who are we going to be? What shows express that value and how does that work? In radio, we are coming up with stuff all the time. No one talks about it. Like, it sort of happens off the side of the desk, all the creativity. But it, again, I run a training program within the ABC, which I developed, called Thriving in Peak Performance. And we talk to senior producers and presenters about leading from the floor. So what does it mean to be a leader in what you do, in how you work with your team and the expectations you put on people around you? And there's this amazing idea that Lindy really put forward, which is she got told halfway through her career, mate, 70% of you is enough. You've been doing this for 15 or 20 years. Yeah, look at your face.
It's outrageous.
Well, so we're told as artists, if you don't give 110, 120%, you know, someone will get ahead of you. Mm. You'll never get there. Mm. Once you've been in the game for 15 years, you should not be working like that. Like, that's not okay. Like, and what are you doing to the people around you if you put that expectation on them? Where if you're doing what we do, which is turn up every single day and deliver to a certain level, you know, there's days that 40% of you is going to get you through it, and that's appropriate, and you shouldn't be digging any deeper, and you shouldn't be asking that of other people. For years when I was working with Joe Spargo, we'd be like, how are you today? She'd be goes, I'm great. I'm like, okay, I'm riding your wave today. And other days I'd be like, I've got everything. She goes, great, because I'm a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So that flexibility is so important, and that maturity. And then there are moments where it is a competition. And there are moments where you do give 110%, but to work like that all the time, I think it's super immature. You know, it's not a mature culture that does that. Where's the reflection?
Well, you'll burn out too,
yeah,
though.
Where's the rest?
Yeah.
I'm just going to draw on memories.
Yeah.
But I do remember being on the floor improvising, and I'd really like to talk about improvisation and the beauty of improvising and being present and being able to tell a story and being able to do that in a team as well. And and so then that's the creativity that comes out from nothing, basically. So normally if we're in some office situation, you've got to have the answers straight away. You present that and then suddenly that's what it is. And I think Kiri Fitzpatrick talks about that quite eloquently. It's just all about how can that improvisation in your thinking or communicating help to create new ideas but not leave people feeling so vulnerable?
So we're vulnerable because we're afraid, and we're afraid of being wrong, and we're afraid of looking stupid. So I ran at the uni for years, a summer school in effective speaking, and these were all academics, and they were really concerned about reputation and sounding like a person who is reliable and can be believed in. So I would start the session by writing the word storyteller on the whiteboard and go, give me words that are associated with storyteller for you. And they would all go silent because they're afraid of saying the wrong thing. And then say, there are no wrong answers. Like, I don't have a plan for this. Just say what comes to your mind. Then they would say what they thought would please me, because they're trained to do that because they're academics.
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, and now what do you really think? Liar, fake, fraud, flim flam, shaman, cheat, you know, that's what people see as storytellers in Australia and in academia particularly. So why is everyone boring when they speak? Because they're trying to sound trustworthy, and that to them is someone with no inflections.
Yeah.
So that's really problematic if you have a voice that's modulated and changes tone because, for example, you're a woman, because, for example, you have a fabulous identity and you're really fun. If you're ethnic and not like Anglo-Australian, who everyone talks like the Australian too, it's really problematic. So we would break down, and it was a very international community at the university. At what point does your accent sound like you're not educated? You've invested, by that point, though, mostly PhDs, 15, 20 years in your education. Mm. Why would you not want to finish the ends of your words? Let's do that. At what point, you know, and it was quite cute actually one time, because we had guys from shipbuildings in Launceston, and they had the same issues with not finishing their sentences as all of the guys from Nepal. And so it's not like it was a ethnic thing necessarily. Yeah. It's just, have you got the conviction of what you're saying to finish the word to the end and still be there? So when we are boring, it's because we're afraid of sounding stupid. And I think what improvisation teaches us is to be unafraid to not know for a while.
Yeah, can we go with that? Because that is one of the key things that early days I learned from you as well, is that it's to not know. It's okay to not
know. And Julie Waddington's spoken about that too. Done theatre, but basically about how that early work, when you're working with people on the floor, that it's about establishing trust and making sure that, yeah, everyone feels confident to be raw with other people.
Yeah, but also, you know, from experiences in different like corporate areas, the experience of people talk over the top of you. They don't allow the space to let you have the floor for a little bit or something like that, for example.
And what you lose then is wonder.
Oh, can we talk about wonder?
Well, wondering, like you wonder about something and so you need to sit with it quietly and wonder about it. I'm from a family where everyone spoke over everyone all the time and it was all about who was the cleverest. That is completely unhelpful in having any new ideas. It's totally useless, people demonstrating their knowledge. And for a lot of people, their whole conversational world is them just saying stuff they know already, especially men. There's no discovery. They go, I have a boat. I also have a boat, but it's slightly larger than your boat. I also have wine. I have wine. So no one's discovering anything in that conversation. And so learning that skill for me was a real, and talking about points of maturation, another massive point at acting school, taking myself to VCA. I look back at the child who did that as I look back at the child who took myself to choir. And I went, you were working out how to heal yourself from your upbringing, from whatever. We all have a story. And that was one of the key things I learned there at VCA with the amazing teachers that we had, was to wonder, to not know, to be curious, to be kind. You'll be kind with the material or it doesn't give itself up to you, doesn't give itself back. Whether that's a piece of fabric you're dancing with or some words on a page or music, you've got to be curious and kind and it will give itself up to you. This brilliant teacher we worked with, Lorna Marshall, said you can speak from rage, you can speak from righteousness, you can speak against injustice, you can speak for joy, you can speak for seduction and provocation, you can't speak from fear. It has no voice and it has nothing to offer us. And you can see in artist development, which I'm really interested in and done a lot of, when people are frightened, they lock themselves at the energy level that they're comfortable at, right? And then they lose all the other notes of their human body or their self. So they might be, you know, good at being sort of winsome and thoughtful, but can't do rage. And in the corporate world, you'll see frightened people will just lock themselves in the space where they know they're okay. They won't leave that space. And that can become a real prison if there's not time to wonder and time to be wrong and permission to fail.
Permission to fail. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big one. I feel like now I'm happy to fail. I don't care. But that's an age thing, isn't it, really? Yes. You just realise, oh, my God, I hung myself out to dry so many times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in an improvisation workshop once and someone came off the floor. It was a group improvisation. It was in Melbourne at Cecil Street Studios, which was this amazing kind of hotbed of creativity. And it was maybe a Barry Lang workshop. Can't remember. Anyway, this guy came off the floor and went, oh, they're giving me nothing. This is terrible. They're just not saying yes. They're a bad improviser. This is hopeless. And the teacher, whether it was Barry or not, just said, well, hang on a second. If you're an improviser and you can't make something off what was there, is that maybe you? What an idea, you know, that the moment's not working because you didn't find something, even if that person's terrible, terrible. This has been really helpful working in a large bureaucracy, which is the ABC. Lots of us work in large bureaucracies. Universities are large bureaucracies. To understand that the nature of a large bureaucracy is that things will often be odd or bureaucratic, or it's a bureaucracy or unhelpful, and that's the nature of it. But how you respond, like, that's your power. Mm. We've got more of a language now, I think, of that psychologically in the world, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know, you do you.
Yeah, it's about you do you. But it is, it's taking ownership of how you approach your ideas and your curiosity and how you treat people as well.
Yeah, and what you can control.
What you can control, that's right.
Coming back to the leadership thing, it's so interesting because I'm flashing back to high school and there was a senior drama club which was run by one English teacher, and she maybe had favourites and was maybe a bit controlling, and it was maybe really about her. And then this other teacher got together a group of rebels and said, why don't you form a drama club? Just a student-led one though, and do your own play. Look, here's a play, Ubu Kwa. Why didn't you put that on? Absurdist. Alfred Jarry wrote it when he was 16. That was the connection.
Yeah.
It's very Trumpian about a king who is like this despotic ruler. And she goes, and I'll just make sure all the forms get signed and stuff, but you guys do it. So me and a couple of other people put this whole show on. I only realized later as an adult that she'd obviously done it to piss this other teacher off. Like, we were tools in a game. But that was the moment where it's like, oh, you can just do this. Like, you have permission to just put a thing on. And
but also actually very clever as a teacher to identify that you that she could all bring you all together.
Yeah.
And you would have that energy level to be able to actually
deliver.
Compete and deliver against that other group.
Yeah, and it was so fun.
Yeah.
And so that was the moment where I think I just went, oh, you can just do
your own way.
Do whatever you want. And I was in a band with some of those friends as well, and we were performing gigs and, you know, in pubs where we weren't allowed to drink, but we were still doing shows because me and my mate Ben had gone out busking aged 14, and we would like sing these post-punk rebellious songs, very inspired by Billy Bragg, outside the 1980s nightclub Candio's, you know, where people with fun jobs and lives would come out with their puffy shoulders and on cocaine. And we're singing about like anarchy, utopia. I had a belief you could do whatever you wanted, you know, that it's all possible.
But you're very confident to have done that when you were young though too.
Yeah.
Not many teenagers these days could busk, I think.
I don't know. I just don't know what that is. If that's just testosterone.
It was probably a combination of things.
You know, that... this is an amazing article in The Guardian by a woman who said, like, us 90s generation who went clubbing and on ecstasy understand menopause because we know what a come down from a drug is. And she's like, estrogen's just a drug. You know, it just makes you loved up and compliant and want things for other people. And now we're coming down off it and we're just going to, like, eat toasted cheese sandwiches and manage it brilliantly. And I thought reading that, what a fucking brilliant frame. Like, without estrogen or testosterone, we're all kind of the same, right? Yeah. And I mean, near enough to this, much more the same than we're different. And that actually really high estrogen and really high testosterone are just super problematic for the effect of running of society or a happy life. And maybe we should be looking at that, you know, and like instead of worrying about trans people or whatever and go, no, you high testosterone dudes, you're real trouble.
Yeah. Everyone needs progesterone, what I always suspected.
There you go. Yeah.
I'm loving it right now.
All I'm hearing from my female friends and colleagues right now is just shit show is the phrase I just hear. It's a shit show.
Yeah.
And I've got my friends where the testosterone starting to drop away and my friends who are 10 years older than me who are like, whoa. All of a sudden, it's like I just see people.
Yeah.
Well. And I care about also them. It's, you know, terrible. Testosterone is full on. Yeah. And I've also seen people transitioning who are like, whoa, I like myself like I've never liked myself. This is awesome.
Yeah.
I have an idea and I'm like, yes. Yeah. I don't ask questions.
Yeah.
So
how much of the lens is actually hormone induced?
I think it's so interesting. Yeah. It's such an interesting question. And us as creators, I was in stand-up comedy at the time where it was very much the thing of like, oh, no one can make a joke anymore because you have to think about everyone's feelings.
Yeah.
And on radio when we were having those public conversations as well. And I'm like, well, come on, like let's think of ways that we can do all of this and still include all of everybody. And it's not actually a massively difficult thing to do. And you can still be funny and you can still be mean and you can still ask these questions, but you can do it with a really kind heart. But as artists, we should be so concerned about how to ask those questions, how to include people. As humans living with lots of testosterone or lots of estrogen, what does that mean? And is it really different, or is this just like great coffee table chat? Mm. And I think that artistic inquiry is really important and valid, as is scientific inquiry. And there's things that science does that no one else can do, and it has built up the best body of knowledge in human history. But there is also a lot of overlooked science and Indigenous knowledge, which is now starting to be discussed and debated and understood in universities, which is super interesting to watch. I am now a warrior for our theatrical knowledge. So I've been making work about masculinity for 25, 30 something years now. And like on that basis, I feel I have observations and things to say that are interesting and provocative and helpful. Mm. They're not scientific truths. I'm not going to go and pair up with a psychologist to go, psychology tells us blah, blah, blah. You know, but there is an artistic experience that's totally legitimate and valid.
Absolutely.
And people who have thought about things and explored them in an embodied way, because in theatre it's you explore it, and they've got things to say about life. So I, with the fucking brilliant book, you know, could go and do a psychology qualification quickly on the side to go, psychologist Rick Goddard says that, you know, sex therapist Rick Goddard. And I'm like, no, like I'm really happy to own my experiences having performed and created shows about masculinity on a national stage for this time, have been in those conversations all that time to go, let's talk about it. Yeah. I think that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Should be validated.
I think it's good.
Yeah. The question of your masculinity. Why did you start doing that? Why was that thematic so important to you? Well, I'm looking at my own femaleness and my womanness.
Yeah.
And as the changes occur, and I always have, but I think I'm owning it more. So I'm in an attempt to understand how you're looking at your masculinity, but you're looking at it from a different angle.
Well, weirdly, the spark was a bit of graffiti on a toilet wall. So I wanted to make a show with my friend John when I was at acting school, and there was just this little thing that said superfluous man. And I didn't realize at the time this was a whole thing in Russia. Maybe at the turn of the century, there were all these sort of educated men who were kind of useless and no one really knew what to do with them. And there's a bourgeoisie. Anyway, I just saw that and I thought, oh, like at that time, Homer Simpson was kind of the iconic male figure, you know. So we're in an era now where men are raised to be told you're toxic. But in that era, it's you're hopeless. The hapless, hopeless, bumbling, you know, fool that you like video games and donuts and you never grow up out of it. That
white men aren't thing. White older men aren't cool right now, in a way, don't you think?
Well, then they were sort of daggy, useless but lovable, and now they're being held to account for everything that's under the surface of that. So a friend of mine said to me, it must be really hard being a white man at the moment. I'm like, not as hard as it is to be anything else. It's still totally the top of the pile. Like every door's open. There's battles that I've had to fight for various reasons because I work in marginal industries like the arts. I'm passionate about working conditions and I will fight for those for myself and other people, which flipping back to leadership, sorry, is the other really critical thing is that leaders, you have to take responsibility. And I've never been afraid to go, I'll protect all of you and I will wear that fuck up. And, you know, I've had people going, oh, I shall quit now. It's so bad, this mistake. I'm like, no, don't quit. You're good. We know you. It's a mistake. I'll own it. We'll move forward. And leaders, if you can't do that, you're not a leader.
Yeah.
I don't know what you are.
Yeah.
But that's not, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that takes a lot of selflessness and guts to be able to take that head on in front of a lot of people to say, I'm owning this. So you've obviously taken on a lot of that responsibility. Is that just a leadership thing?
I want it to be selflessness and guts. Yeah. I'm fucking courageous. Do you know what I think it is? I just think it's like, it's spectrum stuff. I think a lot of it's spectrum stuff. So my mum once we were playing this conversation game and the question was, what's your flaw? She goes, probably overconfident. And I just think in my family there's a bit of spectrum-y stuff and we just don't care.
Yeah,
sure. Normal people care. They would feel humiliated to be in that position. Mm. Don't care, mm. you know. So if I understand that everyone meant well, that we're all still working together and in order for us to move forward someone's got to own it, I'm sure, I don't care. I will not lose sleep over that. That's not, I lose sleep over other things and there are other things I really care about. And I would love it to be a brilliant personal quality. But I just look at my family and I go, my brother is an incredible leader, but he doesn't care about how other people feel. So he can just lead on. You know, this, that lack of empathy is super helpful in certain contexts.
Yeah.
Mm.
But you need to not be blind to that. You need to know that you don't really have it so that you can still care for the feels, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So important.
What do you want to say with our audience? Our audiences are at the moment maybe professionals, maybe non-artists, artists, but seeking creativity in their lives and what the creative rumble is. Some may be blocked, some may be thriving, but I know we want to explore. Everyone's got something creative about them. They don't necessarily have to be an artist. They can build things. They can shape things. They can have ideas. They can be curious. I guess it would be nice to be able to share some more insights about what are some tools.
Because you've had a really creative, brave life. Everything that you're doing, all that's the stories that you've actually spoken about. You've been there for people. You've thrown yourself into the deep end. You have always backed yourself, as you said. Perhaps it was overconfidence, but it doesn't matter. You were still having those experiences. What's your advice for someone that is, they have something deeply creative that they want to do that's inside of them and they haven't taken the first step, don't know what the first step is, or someone that is already really artistic and they still just feel like they're not enough and that they're not doing what they should be, and perhaps that's all constructs anyway, but still.
Well, you're enough. I would say just take a breath and say out loud, I'm here and that's okay, and keep doing that until that's true. So I teach in my presentation skills course and in my coaching this really simple idea, I'm here and that's okay. And I tell a story, which my daughter loves and my son resents because he's not in it, of seeing her be born and her mum needed some attention immediately, so I was left alone with her, this little human, and I realized that in her is literally, provided she is fed and loved, everything she needs to live the complete life of a full human being. Everything is there. And I realized that all that my self-doubt was just so self-indulgent and such total waste of mine and everybody's time because that little being is complete.
Yeah.
And I feel very confident that everyone who listens to this podcast will have experienced seeing that in someone else. Mm-hmm. So I'm here and that's okay. And aside from the very outlying edges of physics and Buddhists, that's true enough for a life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You're here.
Absolutely.
You don't have to explain yourself. You don't have to prove yourself. You exist as much as any other human. So get on with it, you know, like get on with it and do the things. And like you say, everyone's creative. So my partner, bless her, is like many of the people used to do my course. She goes, I'm not creative. And then you go, well, in her case, if you ever see her dressed to go out, like she is just gifting the world. There's amazing energy and colour and style and sense of flair. And actually to do that in a town like Hobart where everyone dresses to the middle of the room and, you know, kill me now, that takes not only creativity but courage, right? And an aesthetic and she's got it going on.
Yeah.
And I've had people who go, oh, I'm not creative, don't have a creative bone in my body. And I'm like, well, you're wearing leopard print shoes that match a leopard print top. So you have something to say.
Yeah.
And you're an accountant. So you're really wanting us to know something. And then she did her first talk on the lunch boxes she makes for her children. Cause actually I'm a boring mum. And one was a rainforest and another was a desert and another was a this, and that was the food. And I'm like, come on, what have we done in Australia to make creativity something that's for kids?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not an adult pursuit. It's very immature sort of idea. Mm. And I think to live fully, there's only a few places in which we're fully alive, and we're fully alive when we're creating.
Yeah.
Like that chakra is the base of everything. So if you're not creating, you're not fully alive.
Yeah.
There's also a whole thing sexually about that. Like if you're not sexually realizing whatever your thing is for you.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has to come out to themselves. I think that's we all got to work out for ourselves what that is.
Yeah.
Because when you live that, it's very different than when you don't live that. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that part of your energy that creates.
Yeah.
I love the phrase creative rumble, by the way. Oh. Your podcast is fucking cool because
thank you.
It rumbles, like it's down below.
Yeah.
It's rumbling under there and it's got to get out. And like, yes, if we make people that can satisfy that a lot and exhausting, but the amount of time happily now in our lives that we spend making people is quite limited. Like very few of us are having 17 children through a lifetime.
Yeah.
There's a lot of other creative acts to engage in, and there is creative acts with ourselves, and there's creative acts with other people. And my week at the moment, I do my program every day. So I'm collaborating with at least one other producer, if not more, to tell 9 different stories every day and try and make the weather also a fun story and the traffic a fun story. You know, like it's everything's got to be alive. And then I've got my band, and then I've got my music duo with my other friend, and then I do dance classes with drill. And I'm doing a music theatre thing with my daughter because she asked me to do that, and that's a space for us to be together. It was amazing. Yeah. And she'll be, you know, but my kids are a bit older. So it's also that thing of if you're in that point where your people are small or your older people in your life, their needs are really high, you've got to get your expectations to the bit of time you have.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice.
Yeah.
Because, I know just with the phase of life that my children are at, I can pull away a little bit now, a bit more, and that's so fun. But there was a long time.
I'm going to be in this room for half an hour, leave me alone.
Yeah.
And they can now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was a long time where I was there. Oh no, I feel like, you know, it's overwhelming. I've just got to do all this stuff and I can't get like physically out of the house. And so, I think naming that up, that's a real feeling. That's great. Yeah.
Well, I would also say to this audience, as you described them, Australian motherhood is one of the hardest motherhoods in the world. There's studies in this. Yeah. And the amount of hours that Australian mothers spend with their children are higher than nearly any other mothers in the world. Mm. The amount of expectation and the load and how that's shared for Australian mothers is also higher than anyone else in the world. So here's the thing. Don't allow anyone to live in your house who isn't pulling their weight.
Making friends and influencing people. Yeah.
No, like fuck that. Fuck that. Like when was that, you know, that's still acceptable, I find astonishing. And I've been through divorce season and dating season and what a weird and interesting,
seasons.
Oh my God. But you get to see in a whole lot of people's lives and the accords that they've made with the father of their children, and that relationship never stops and it's complicated. Then they're trying to make new relationships. And there's just still a bunch of people, men out there who don't pull their weight. They're a net burden to existence, which is another concept that's in the fucking brilliant book, which is like, you're not fuckable if you're on the list.
Hmm.
Like the second you're on her list, you're like a child or a geriatric. So you've got to stay off the list. You've got to be enough ahead of the game domestically, never be on that list, because why would you have sex with someone who's on the list?
I can't believe it's not published already.
Right. It's unbelievable. Because no one wants a book from a man like me at a time like this. Like, stay off the list.
Need it. Let's get it out there.
We'll because
that's the title of the second book.
Yeah, yeah.
That was clever.
Stay off the list.
Yeah, stay off. I'm writing that down.
Because, it's just like.
Oh, that's funny.
It's really boring to say to men, housework is sexy, because we know fucking isn't. And if housework was sexy, then our female partners would be wanting to do it, and that would be a turn on. And we'd all, it's drudgery and it's exhausting and it's hard work, right? And staying on top of it mentally, as well as just the physical doing of it, is also hard work. So if anyone is doing too much of that, it's not sexy. And if both of you are performatively doing it to each other to show each other how much you're doing to do the performative thing, that's also not sexy.
Right?
This fucking horrible, so boring, performative drudgery. Oh my God. So if you're two people with jobs, you have to pay someone to clean your house if you're trying to raise children. Like, we don't outsource in Australia enough. We don't outsource that work in Australia enough. And it is partly because we try and pay everyone fair wages, and so then it gets expensive really quickly. But again, the expectations, and I've had so many women say this to me, going, I couldn't get a cleaner. My mother never had a cleaner. My sister has more children than me and doesn't have a cleaner. I'm like, yeah, but they live full time at
home. My house doesn't get clean unless I have a cleaner.
Yeah.
Because I'm prioritizing and I'm prioritizing if everyone's wearing clean clothes and they've got food and there's food in the fridge and the lights work and that's what I can do. I can do that and my job and all my creative things, and that's how we're rolling. If anyone's got a problem with it, let me know.
Yeah. And people choose different standards of what that means for children to be fed, for example. So for some people that means there's food in the house and the children can go and get it.
Yeah.
And for other people that is cooking elaborate meals every day and making an incredible lunchbox and also afternoon tea and more. Like, I grew up latchkey kid, so the idea that there was some woman standing around the house feeding you things at afternoon tea time, I'm like, that's not a job. Like I can find my own food for afternoon tea as a child. And ironically, I've kind of become that person, but I love cooking for the family.
Aww.
And I do most of the cleaning now. But when we were both really busy, we had a cleaner and with my fiance now, but also she has lowered her bar. So here's the other top tip: lower the bar. So if you have foolishly enrolled your children in a private school, so they need like 3 or 4 or 5 clean uniforms a week, right? Okay, your bar is very high for that's a lot of laundry. If they're in a state school, they'll get 2 shirts a week, they'll be fine, right? And one pair of shorts will last for a guy like a couple of weeks. Like, lower the bar. And you've got to own some of those choices. But at the same time, does every cushion have to be fluffed? Does the carpet have to be clean? Where can you just let it go so that near enough is good enough? And one of the things that I love that theatre taught me is that when the lights are down, near enough is often good enough. Perfectionism is a freaking curse. So this would be lesson 3, creative people. Don't be perfect.
Yeah.
Make things that aren't very good, that's fine for a while, you know, when you're exploring.
Yeah.
And only aim for perfection if that's really going to matter, like it's structural. That's important.
Because perfectionism can actually stop you from actually doing anything even to begin with.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
I had a friend say to me when I wrote my first show, which was like a music theatre comedy show with my mate Stuart in Wellington, Not Responsible. And I got my mate Donald to work on it, and he said, I'm going to try and make a silk purse out of the sow's ear. This writing is horrible. This is terrible. The jokes are awful. It's not even funny. I'm like, yeah, but he goes, well, you finished something. I haven't even started anything.
Yeah.
And we did the show, and because I'd done that show, then I did another show, and because I did, and by the time I did my third show, it was a hit.
Yeah.
It was super successful.
Yeah.
And you've got to be willing to do some bad work.
Yeah.
And in a mature culture accepts that from artists. So not as much in Australia, but very much in New Zealand. If you don't turn out like a hit every time, people just stop talking to you.
We're in New Zealand.
Yeah. Tall poppy syndrome, New Zealand specializes. Australia dreams of tall poppy syndrome like they do it in New Zealand. In New Zealand, people just go, it wasn't very good. I didn't know what to say to them. And I haven't spoken to her for 4 months. That was, when I was there, quite normal. It might have changed. It was hardcore. That's partly why I'm in Australia. Mm-hmm. I moved here because there was more acceptance for having a go. There was enthusiasm for that. Yeah. You did it.
Yeah.
Well, other people didn't do it. So you did it.
Yeah.
Didn't work. You did it.
Yeah.
It's better here.
Mm.
But individually, people... And especially, I think, you know, if you're a woman living in a patriarchy, perfectionism is a torment. But you know that if you don't put yourself out perfect, you're going to get taken down like ultra hard, much harder.
Yeah.
So I realized that every single job I've been given, people took a massive punt on me. And I think that I want to see a world where that just as massive punt gets applied to a greater range of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't not do that.
Yeah.
Diligence is so boring.
Yeah.
Really. And I don't think a lot of excellence comes from diligence, yeah, strangely.
Yeah.
Of like, have you proven that you have 9 out of 10 of the selection criteria? Yeah. Like, no one's got 9 out of 10 of the selection criteria. No one fun. So get that person who's really promising, but then you have to put around them. And I think this is a really big issue in broadcasting, and it's a really big issue in leadership in Australia, that the more people deviate from a wealthy, highly supported upbringing with a high education, that white middle class, upper middle class thing, then the more supports have to be put around them for them to succeed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's got to be strategic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I raised this once in the context of the ABC, and people are saying, are you saying women can't hack it, Rick? And I'm going, no, I said women in public spaces are exposed in a very different way than a man is exposed in a public space.
Yeah.
And my fun analogy for it is that if a man is a flasher, right, if he's an exhibitionist in that way, he'll just get behind a bush and go, right? If a woman is an exhibitionist in that way, she'll do a burlesque show.
Yeah.
There'll be context and it'll be beautifully presented and the people there will be given consent to see what they're seeing.
Yeah.
You just don't get many chicks who are flashers in that way, except Australasian women in pubs in London. You know? So I think that that's still something that we're trying to understand in culture. When we look for leaders, people are going, we want a safe pair of hands. And that looks like what we've seen. And people break down walls and you get new generations of people who get themselves seen as leaders, and it's changing. But then how do boards actually consciously support that? Right, and go, okay, well, this person's brilliant but has 3 children and 4 elderly parents and is divorced. So what does work look like for this person? Yeah. You know.
Yeah. We really want that person, but we're going to work out how to support them is ideally what they should be saying.
Yeah, and if we want diversity within our organisation, then we need diverse ways of engaging with people, and we need to understand from those people what a safe workplace or a workplace, what was that word, that you can thrive in, looks like for them, and not go, you've got to turn into one of us to be comfortable, because it doesn't happen. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I really like you. Have you come back now? We've come back a little bit full circle into talking about from your experiences of in the beginning of losing your position at the company.
Oh, yeah. Then,
but it just feels like all of that has been impetus for you, from my perspective here now today, of that it's just you've gone in and you're making sure everyone is treated in a way that is respectful and kind, and you've found new methods, you're pursuing new ways of communicating with people to ensure that everyone gets a fair go.
It's such a youngest child thing, isn't it? Such a like, I just want everyone to understand each other. Yeah, like, and that it's fair. Like, youngest children care about fairness so much because
they do.
And then they exploit it and get a way better deal than their older siblings ever had. Yeah. And the siblings are like, so unfair, you got everything. I'm like, better negotiator, suck that. It really matters to me. And I'm really interested, like, when I had this moment, I turned 50 a few years ago and was like, oh my God, I did it. I have had a creative career. Mm. All my life I've been paid actually quite well to be creative and to do things I enjoy, and crikey, got away with it. It happened. Mm.
Yeah.
And did I have the hit that I wanted? No. Am I as famous as I had hoped to be? No. Is my success in a major capital of a known place? No, it's in Hobart, whatever, it's fine. But I've lived that life. My every day, my days are just filled with making beautiful things with really interesting people, whatever that has been. So now what do you do, you know, with that experience?
Yeah.
So coming back to then to create, how do you fit creativity in when you're in one of those stages of living where life's asking heaps of you? And so hello choirs. So I sang in this choir where you just turn up once a week and sing with some people, and then they only had 1 showing or 2 showings. So not one of those choirs where they're like, oh my God, we've been asked to sing 8 times. Like, just like, you've got to find something really locked down.
Yeah.
that is that you can just tick it over.
And it can still fill your emotional bucket.
That choir, yeah, yeah. Oh my God. You know, Jane Edwards was conducting and she is just brilliant and terrifying. So you got to be a little bit scared and a little bit excited. And they were mostly musicians in that choir. So I stood between two people who sang so beautifully that I just believed that was my voice. And you lose yourself in the sound and you belong. And it was in a really difficult time of my life and I felt incredibly isolated and I was working 1.5+ jobs and trying to do my family life and that's all there was room for. You know, I haven't done theatre for years. It just, it's too much.
You were sound healing yourself there.
I was sound healing, yeah. And, I mean, I did sing as well, I think I sang. I gave up comedy because, like, if you've done breakfast radio all week, like the idea of waiting till 10:30 at night to be on is just
you want to be impossible. In bed by now.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I let go a lot of my writing. Yeah. I just didn't have capacity. And
that's nice that's come back to you, though.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
I love the fact that, you know, we talk about hierarchy before, but there is no hierarchy in what you're actually participating in a creative way. You're investigating and you're curious about life and then you will try new things. You're always trying new things.
Yeah, so that's ego, right? Like that's about being egoless and going.
Egoless.
So I dance every week in the independent dance class at Drill.
Yeah.
And like my daughter is in Drill. She's like the artist on the board now. My stepdaughters are also in Drill. I go to the indie class. Mostly it's people who have danced all their life. It's being led by the artistic director of Drill, Tara Robertson, at the moment. It was Beck before that. And I'm hopeless.
But you're having the time of your life.
Oh, my God. And it's so good for my brain at the end of the week because I can't do choreography and it messes with my head. And you can literally feel the neurons and the patterns being broken and new things forming.
Yeah, and that's so golden. My sister's just started tap dancing classes.
Oh,
and
that's brave.
That's adorable.
And
that's
I just said, how are you going? And I said, I want to, and she's like, oh, great. I've got big expressive arms.
Yeah, no, that's what she said, and a smiley face.
And a smiley face. Like, perfect. And great outfits and hair. And I said, I need photos. Yeah. But it is.
Yeah. So here's one way to think about it. If you're such a responsible person that you can only do things because they're good for you, doing new things and being bad at them is insurance against Alzheimer's. So unwiring and rewiring your brain constantly is like a massive protection against dementia and Alzheimer's. So learning things is really good. Part of the reason I'm doing powerlifting is because if you're really strong, that's another 5 years before you have a fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's bone density and muscle density.
Yeah.
I ran for a long time. I just got really sick of it after a while because it's really boring. After the 15th kilometer, you're like, oh, God, am I still here? Far out. So I think I like novelty and it gives you a broad view, but you will never go as far as someone who gives themselves to something completely.
Yeah.
I think when I was at acting school, when Mira is, like, we pretty much were able to give ourselves to that completely.
Yeah. And privileged time.
And then there's times you can't. But here's the thing, like, again, most people now alive now are going to be living till 75, 80, 90. If you've lived better than me, 110. So there's still a lot of years to come. And there's people producing amazing work in those years. And the idea that that is elderly, like elderly is out to 85 now. So there's a whole lot of really productive years coming where you have time and it's yours. I'm getting a taste of it now, but I'm living with someone who's 10 years younger than me or 9 years and she's in the trenches. And that's really interesting because I can support her to a point, but there's a point I'm not going there where I'm like, hey, like, sorry, my life's heaps nicer than yours, but I have done all of that. I will do everything to make it less shitful for you, but they have a father. He needs to do his parts. I'll pick up as much as I can, but also having learned late in life to have any boundaries at all, I don't ever resent her and I don't resent my stepchildren. And she just had some surgery. I just stepped up for that now and they're like, oh God, you can do all these things. And I'm like, damn.
You've shown your cards.
I don't know how to, but it's an amazing time as it comes back in, right? And you go, ooh, I have a half hour here. Oh, I've got that afternoon's free.
Yeah.
Mm.
So my kids are just doing their driver's licenses. One drives and one's about to get his. And that's another level of terror.
Yeah, because your heart's now driving around in space.
Yeah. So yeah. Bad. Like, it's funny, and they learn differently. So my daughter learns incrementally within where she's comfortable and moves forward like that. So I actually really, teaching her was quite safe and enjoyable. And even though she's driving around with music theatre turned up really loud singing, and I don't know, she's probably closing her eyes half the time to feel it, I feel really safe about her. But my son learns by throwing himself at the world and seeing what sticks. And it's just a really bad methodology for driving. So we've been having a lot of conversations.
Oh, really?
About that. Yeah.
Maybe you should drive manual and not automatic.
He is
You'll be more
drive
focused.
Manual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. That'll work for him.
Mm. Cool.
That's so great.
Well, thank you.
Wow. I just gobsmacked. Thank you so much, Rick. You're so generous and kind, and you share so much of yourself with the world. And it's, you know, a pleasure to have you here today on the Creative Rumble. I've been so excited and just...
She's fangirling.
I'm just...
I think she's really politely going, God, you monologue. Jeez. On you go.
I thought I haven't known you as long as Laura has, but it was so lovely to hear all about your life and all your lessons and all the colours.
Thank you so much. Mm.
Yeah. I feel like I haven't given you a proper enough intro, but I'm going to do that later. And then I feel like, yeah, like this wrapping up is really...
You don't want it to end?
No, because I love you, Rick. It's so lovely to reconnect with you.
Oh,
thank you.
Oh, it really is. Laura came and did a photo shoot. You did a photo shoot with my band.
Oh, hey, I have lived in Tasmania for 18 years and I had heard of your name, but that was the first time I actually... had like heard about you.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Can I make you cry more? Are you still recording?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, stopped. So.
She loves crying on the
So paper. I got.
That's my jam.
I got, that job ended really badly and I had children before all my peers had children, and so I became completely isolated from my theatre family.
Yeah.
And I was freelancing. So I went from the status of being the artistic director to, you know, freelance. Mm-hmm. Then I got into radio and then there was just no theatre in my life at all. And I bumped into you and my life was just work and being put down, and it was really unpleasant. And I bumped into you at Tricycle when it was a bar, and we had a dance on the dance floor, and every single bit of our history of those hundreds of hours of improvisation, of all of that learning, of all of the collaborations was just there in all of that movement, and none of it was gone. And that turned a light on for me about what was and wasn't okay about what was going on for me in my life at that time.
Aww. I'm glad that happened. Yeah, to get that change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
thank
I think
you.
It just, it's a reminder that any time you've spent creating things is never wasted, even though you might never know where it's going to work or come out or have meaning.
Yeah. It's all been like talking about energy.
Energy and flow.
Yeah.
There's this amazing theatre artist and intellectual, his name may or may not come to me as I tell this story, but he talks about artists as an archipelago of islands, that we're all in our little spaces doing our own work, but as soon as we connect with each other, we understand each other completely. And I will go and see Melanie Tate, who I met as a radio presenter, but she also was an artistic director too young like me and had... issues around that, and we'd connected over that. Anyway, she's very successfully writing plays now, and I'll go to her openings and I'll hang out with her cast afterwards, and my fiance will be, these are your people, aren't they? She's never seen me in a show. Yeah. She's never seen me in a theatre thing. She goes, these are your people. I'm like, yeah, they're my people.
Yeah. And I think the other reason why I'm getting all clammed up when I talk to you is because I think I did that back in, I never, like, improvisation and words has never been my strong point. But it's actually like I messaged you the other day. I said, you'd be really proud of my basic improvisational storytelling, because we did Echo Festival and you just threw the mic at me because you had to check something. And I'm like, oh, I've got it now. Like,
we then couldn't get it off it. Yeah.
I described all the costumes and then made like some sort of surreal like story, and people were like, some people liked it. But again, it was like going back to the beginning again, back to the roots. Because I did do like theatre school and I created my own work, but it wasn't until like getting into Is Theatre was the most influential time.
That's it was a long
year.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like 2 years worth of training, but that first year we learned so much.
But it's non-stop practice as well. Like you're always applying. It's always applied and it's always applied.
And you'll always find, I mean, yeah, always finding new ways.
And it's interesting because what makes a great improviser is good listening. And people on radio go, oh, you get paid to talk for a living. I go, no. I do the talking for free. I get paid to listen because it's the listening that's the skill. We haven't even talked about taste. So artists, what we all have in common is choosing things. That's maybe the only thing we all have in common is taste. And I'm pretty confident AI can't replace taste. So that's good to hang on to, is that your aesthetic that you develop, like what is good taste? I know it's good taste and bad taste, high art, low art, that's irrelevant now. But taste, a selection of things is hugely powerful. And so when we're putting radio program together between me and the producer, we'll have lots of choices. Mostly the producer does this. So they produce the show and I'll present it. And I love that workflow because they have ownership, I have ownership. But yeah, we've got to choose things that we think will work for the audience. And what's been interesting with Breakfast Radio, because I came as a theatre person, so I didn't accept any of their truths as given of what you do for breakfast. This is what a breakfast show is. And at the time, there were some rules. There's no vaginas on breakfast. We don't talk about mental health on breakfast. It's got to be fun. And you don't do any politics because that's Tim Cox on mornings. Tim Cox does that on mornings. Oh, but mornings, I mean, it's really important to have long interviews where you can hold people to account and analyze it. But also, like, it's good for people to get information quickly. So we decided a few things. One of them was that people are busy in the mornings. Hobart, we don't have long commutes, so people aren't bored. So we're going to present you stuff and give it to you and not make you work very hard for it. So we started asking a bit less of the audience. I think people have really liked that. And we have done a lot in terms of community, but unlike in theatre, you know, we hope in theatre that when we do a show, it's going to change the world.
Yeah.
Radio is like water on a stone. So it's conversation after conversation after conversation after conversation after conversation that can change things.
Slowly start to weather.
Yeah. And I learned, because I'm quite an opinionated person, and that is very unhelpful on the radio unless you want to do divisive radio, Carl Sanderlin's sort of thing, which is really effective, but that's not local radio's brief, is that learn to stand alongside your audience. Mm. Everyone, whether they agree or disagree, is totally unimportant. To stand alongside and look and regard something together and consider it together and practice civil conversation. And I think that's what local radio is, this amazing beacon of how do we people who don't agree have a civil conversation about it and move forward a step. So we've got this filter for our breakfast program that we don't do a story if it doesn't move it forward. So we don't just roll around. Oh, it was traumatizing and how did that feel and was it so bad? And like we're in there like, what are you doing to move this forward? How is this going to improve the situation for people? And I guess there's a, in a sense, that's progressive.
Practical.
But yeah. Yeah, pragmatic.
Pragmatic.
Pragmatic. And local radio listeners, it's not a really brandy brand. Like Triple J is cool and young. Double J is old and cool. Classic FM, sophisticated, or a music lover. And they've really changed their brand actually from snobby Classic FM to like we love music. Yeah. And it's so much more inclusive and so much more fun. Really love that station. You know, Triple M is men who like sports and the women who love them despite themselves. And we're like, local radio is what? You know, it's what? And I think it's people who want things to be done well. They want the community to be cohesive. They would like everyone to feel that they belong. And they want people who are paid to do their job to do it properly. And they really care about that and gardening. And
gardening's a big one.
They're the best people.
Yeah.
Like these are the people that keep the whole of society moving. So you've got like 1% at the top who are parasites and 1% at the bottom who are parasites. And then all through there's little psychopaths spotted everywhere operating in their own interests. And all of the rest of us go, do you know what? I could confront that person, but I'm just going to avoid the conflict and we'll get on with the day. And that is the wheels turning of our world. And they're the people we need to look after.
Mm.
And those people are massively under attack at the moment.
Yeah,
that's right.
Mm. Okay.
Well, I'm really glad that you're behind the mic, Rick, because you've got so much to share and bring people together. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on the Creative Rumble.
Thanks for asking. So nice.
Hey, listeners. We hope you're enjoying the Creative Rumble podcast.
If you're loving the content, why not share the podcast with someone who could use some creative inspiration?
We'd also love to hear from you. Drop us a note via our website or Instagram. Your feedback and stories make this podcast even better.
And if you want to support us further, get online to our website and click on the Buy Us a Coffee link. Your donation keeps the Creative Rumble alive.
You can find all the links in the show notes. Thank you for being a part of our creative community.
Until next time, keep rumbling.